Hello friends, I'm Steve Larson, Music Director of the Rockford Symphony. Spring is usually a very busy time of the year for us. We're wrapping up our last two classics concerts and our final Pops concert of the season. Our annual youth concert would be coming up. We have a couple of open principal chairs in the orchestra, and we've scheduled auditions for them. Instead, we find ourselves with a lot of time on our hands. I should be studying Prokofiev's Fifth Symphony and learning the score for Beauty and the Beast right now, but I'm sitting at home trying to make the best of the situation. I certainly miss the rehearsals, the preparation, especially the concerts themselves. I miss you, our audience, and I miss our musicians. I've had a lot of time to think about all this, how all this feels to me, and I've come to understand that what I miss the most is the ability to share my love of music with you. It's not really a case of just wanting to perform for an audience. I think of what I do as an act of invitation and sharing. At rehearsals, I try to share my ideas about the music with the orchestra, then we all work together to share it with you. I love the Soundbites luncheons on the day before a classics concert because it gives me a chance to share a conversation with our guest artist, letting you into that fascinating world of the virtuoso performer. And the pre-concert talks. I could ask somebody smarter and more eloquent than me to give you the background of the music you're about to hear, and it would probably make concert days less tiring for me. But I love being able to tell you how I feel about a composer or a certain work, and how I see it all fitting into the big picture. Last year, Phil Davidson and I started doing a podcast before every concert, a couple of weeks ahead, and the number of listeners has been growing steadily. Recording a podcast is something one can do without leaving the house. Just record it and put it up on the website where anybody can click on it and listen. Question is, if I'm going to do one, what am I going to talk about? It seems a little pointless, maybe even a little bit cruel to talk about concerts that aren't going to happen. I suppose I could do little mini courses about music, kind of music appreciation light for the digital age, and share my thoughts about various composers, stylistic periods, music history, and such. But frankly, that's all available out there already in libraries and YouTube clips and endless internet resources. It finally occurred to me that there's one topic I've never talked about in a pre-concert talk or a Center for Learning and Retirement course or a lunchtime talk to a Rotary Club. When I thought of it, I had one of those Homer Simpson "Dole!" moments. Why didn't I think of this before? So I'm going to talk to you about something very, very dear to my heart and something we all are missing in our isolation. The orchestra. Not the RSO in particular, but that wonderful creation of humankind that's been the common denominator of every symphony concert for centuries and has provided countless millions with joy and inspiration. That miracle that happens when dozens of highly trained instrumentalists gather together to play great music for you, the audience. This is the first of an unnumbered series of podcasts about the orchestra. I say unnumbered because I started out with the idea of doing just one. But as I sketched out ideas I wanted to talk about, it kept growing and growing. So I don't know how many there will be or exactly how deep we'll dive into this. I'll keep cranking them out until either A, I run out of things to say, B, you plead with me to stop for the love of all things holy, or C, we start playing concerts again. Personally, I'm hoping for C, but meanwhile, this will keep me off the streets. This, then, is podcast number one of X. What is an orchestra? In 1964, former Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart wrote that he couldn't define pornography, but he knew it when he saw it. It's like that with orchestras too, isn't it? We know what they look like. We know what they sound like. And we know what they aren't, even if we're not quite sure how to say what they are. When you think of an orchestra, what comes to mind? Maybe you have a mental picture of the Rockford Symphony and the Coronado stage. Strings in the front, violins on the left, cellos, violas, and basses on the right, woodwind center, brass in the back, percussion in the corner. Yes, that's an orchestra. But if you've attended a number of concerts, you've probably noticed that this picture sometimes changes. Sometimes there's a harp, sometimes not. Sometimes there's a tuba, sometimes not. Sometimes there are two horns, sometimes four horns. Almost never one or three. The percussion section sometimes gobbles up nearly a third of the stage. Sometimes it's not there at all. Except for the timpani, which we have always at least two, sometimes three or four or five drums. They're always, almost always, found at the back of the stage. So it would seem like an orchestra can change a bit, grow, shrink, push out in one direction or the other, and still be recognizable as an orchestra. Now that you've conjured up a picture of an orchestra, what about familiar instruments you don't see on the stage? I know many of you have played in bands in high school or college. Where are the mellifluous baritone horns and euphoniums that so often carry the beautiful melodies in concert band literature? Where are the sousaphones? You know, if we had three of them, we could have RSO covers over their bells. And why are there no saxophones? Well, I confess that the saxophone isn't my favorite instrument, but I promise to give them their due in a future podcast and explain why we don't regularly use them. There are a lot of little details that maybe you've noticed but never thought about. Why do wind and brass players each have their own music stand, but string players have to share one with a partner? Why do clarinetists sometimes change instruments during a concert? Why are some brass instruments brass-colored and others are silver? Why are the double basses always on the right side of the stage? And have you noticed that the double basses are not exactly the same shape as their smaller cousins, the cellos? Why is that? Why does the orchestra tune to the oboe? And, especially to those of you who have played in bands, why do orchestras tune to A and not B flat? I promise we'll get to all those questions eventually, but first, I'd like to paraphrase Shakespeare, because quoting Shakespeare always makes one sound intelligent and well-informed. What's in a name? That which we call an orchestra by any other name would sound as sweet. That group of people in your mind's eye, the 30, 40, 50, or even 100 people playing musical instruments, is an orchestra. I think Justice Stewart would agree. Does that word orchestra really mean something? Can we learn anything from it? We use orchestra as part of our corporate name, the Rockford Symphony Orchestra, even though in casual conversation it usually gets dropped. This is pretty typical everywhere. The Rockford Symphony, Chicago Symphony, Elgin Symphony, Grant Park Symphony, and so on. The word orchestra is dropped because it's understood. It's a given. We don't need to waste our breath saying it. That's really ironic, because I think that the word orchestra is probably the least understood part of those names. The word orchestra is usually preceded by a descriptive word that's intended to tell us a little bit more about what the group's purpose is. We speak of a symphony orchestra, ballet orchestra, opera orchestra. Try to visualize each one of them. The symphony orchestra on a stage in a concert hall, the ballet orchestra in the pit in front of a stage as dancers perform, the opera orchestra in what might be the same pit in front of the same stage, except that tonight's performance happens to be an opera. Are there different instruments in each of these orchestras? No, not really. Tchaikovsky wrote his Symphony No. 5 for the same orchestra used for his ballet Swan Lake and his opera Eugene Onegin. In some cities, the symphony orchestra, ballet orchestra, and opera orchestra are all the same. They use the same musicians. Different descriptive names, but pretty much identical in membership and appearance. Composers use something called an orchestra for different purposes. It seems, then, that the word orchestra needs a little help in defining its mission, and we apply descriptors like symphony, ballet, and opera to do so. Since we call ourselves the Rockford Symphony Orchestra, let's take a closer look at that word symphony. Does the Rockford Symphony play symphonies? Well, yes, as a matter of fact, we do play symphonies. More often than not, a classics concert will include a work that is called a symphony, and very often it's the featured work on that program. And even when we play ballets or operas, we are still called a symphony orchestra. It would appear that the word symphony is very important. In linguistics, the most important words tend to be recognizable across a broad spectrum of foreign languages. For instance, every language has identical or very similar words for mama and papa. Almost as widely recognized throughout the world are the words for coffee and chocolate, which I think are almost as important to life as mothers and fathers. The word symphony has an easily recognizable cognate in every European language. You can even find it in the Finno-Ugric languages, like Latvian, Lithuanian, Finnish, and Hungarian, which developed outside the Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, Romance, and Slavic languages that most European languages are based on. Every European language's word for symphony or symphonic is recognizable for having come from the same root. The Latin symphonia, which means agreeable or concordant sounds, and that in turn derives from the ancient Greek symphony, which is itself an accretion of two words that mean sounding together. Long before there was something called a symphony orchestra, and before the musical genre called the symphony was invented, the word symphony, or its foreign language equivalent, was used to describe pleasant and agreeable instrumental compositions, as opposed to works for voice, even though one assumes works for voice were also pleasant and agreeable. In operas and other works for voices, instrumental interludes were often called symphonies. Eventually, these instrumental works would grow into the multi-movement works for orchestras we call symphonies today, but that's not really relevant to this discussion. Ensembles that specialized in playing symphonies, among other instrumental works, on stages in concert halls came to be called symphony orchestras. The English-speaking world has taken that concept even further. One definition of the word symphony is a concert played by a symphony orchestra, whether or not a symphony is performed. While I was mentioning orchestras with symphony in their names, were any of you thinking, what about the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, or the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra? If a symphony orchestra plays symphonies, a ballet orchestra plays ballets, and an opera orchestra plays operas, does a philharmonic orchestra play philharmonics, whatever they might be? Well, in a word, no. The word philharmonic comes from two Latin words which mean love of harmony, and that's actually a pretty good synonym for the symphony's backstory of being agreeable sounds. The word philharmonic and symphony as modifiers to orchestra are really interchangeable. Matter of choice. The use of one word or the other is usually more a question of branding or corporate identity than actual meaning. Take the case of the New York Philharmonic, one of the world's great orchestras. In late 19th century New York, an intense rivalry existed between the New York Symphony Society and the older and fustier Philharmonic Symphony Society of New York. Both organizations presented well-attended and prestigious orchestral concerts. The New York Symphony specialized in French and Russian romantic repertoire, while the Philharmonic excelled in German works. Carnegie Hall was actually built to be the home of the New York Symphony. These two orchestras existed as rivals until 1928, when they merged and began performing under the name New York Philharmonic Orchestra. Does the name New York Symphony have a contemporary ring to you? If so, you've probably watched the television series Mozart in the Jungle, where it was the featured, if fictional, ensemble. Some orchestras don't bother using either symphony or philharmonic. There is the Philadelphia Orchestra, the Cleveland Orchestra, the Minnesota Orchestra, just to name three. In the 1990s, were you a Jay Leno or David Letterman fan? I watched the old Late Show with David Letterman, and I always gritted my teeth at the beginning when the announcer introduced Paul Schaefer and the CBS Orchestra. Anybody could see that this wasn't an orchestra. It was a band. A very good one, I might add. But deep down inside, this troubled me because I thought I had missed something in my education. Did I skip class the day a professor defined the word orchestra to include any instrumental ensemble that just minimally included a string bass? Years later, I found out that the name Paul Schaefer and the CBS Orchestra came about because of a legal dispute that arose when Letterman left NBC and moved to CBS. At NBC, Schaefer had called his group the world's most dangerous band, and the NBC legal department wouldn't let CBS use that name. I'm guessing that they claimed that every word of the name except the was the intellectual property of NBC, and so it became the CBS Orchestra, three words that NBC couldn't claim to own, and all this without having to add a single violin. But I digress, as often I do. Yes, an orchestra has stringed instruments, but not just any stringed instruments. Guitars, banjos, ukuleles, sitars, psalteries, lutes, theorbos, and lyres don't count. The occasional harp is welcome, but its presence doesn't make an ensemble an orchestra. Violins? Getting warmer now. Except that 100 Suzuki violinists standing together and playing Twinkle Twinkle Little Star is not an orchestra. It needs more than that. As you probably know by now, we need some combination of violins, violas, cellos, and basses, stringed instruments of the same type, though of different sizes, that are played with bows. And not just four or five of them, but 10 or 20 or more. But again, I ask the annoying question, why? Who said so? We'll look at this later. Perhaps we could save some time by consulting an expert. You know the definition of an expert. Somebody you pay to read your watch and tell you what time it is. Even so, dictionary definitions can be helpful. So let's see what Merriam-Webster's online dictionary has to say about the word orchestra. Orchestra, noun, a group of instrumentalists, especially one combining string, woodwind, brass, and percussion sections, and playing classical music. Let's zero in on this. First, a group of instrumentalists, not singers. Check. Especially one combining string, woodwind, brass, and percussion sections. A key word here is sections, implying multiple strings, woodwinds, brass, and percussion. And especially meaning not necessarily all of them. Playing classical music. Classical. Now there's a loaded word. Highbrow music, serious music, art music. The kind of music that used to be called long-haired music before country and western hijacked the hairdos. What's another way of describing classical music? How about like the kind of music that orchestras play? Oh, we're back to the beginning, aren't we? Merriam-Webster goes on to explain the origins of the word orchestra. I think that examining the roots of the word symphony was useful and interesting, so let's look at orchestra. Orchestra, the ancient Greek word for the semicircular space in front of an ancient Greek theater stage where the chorus danced and sang. I find this fascinating for two reasons. First, between the 5th century BCE and the modern era, there was no intermediary version of the word orchestra in Latin or any other language. This suggests that the idea lay dormant for over 1,000 years. Second, when we travel back in time to examine the ancient Greek origins of this word, poof, the musicians all disappear. In the Greek definition of orchestra, there are no musicians, only floor space at the front of the theater stage. Their orchestra was not a group of people playing instruments. It was the area at the front of a stage. And when it was occupied by people, those people were dancing and singing, not playing instruments. At first, this might seem useless to us, but keep it in mind. We'll come back to it in a future podcast. Well, back to the dictionary definition. An orchestra is especially made up of strings, woodwinds, brass, and percussion. Okay, how many of each? In what proportions? How many strings are too few? How many woodwinds are too many? Can we call it an orchestra if there are only strings? I think that everybody who has attended orchestra concerts with any degree of regularity can make a pretty good guess about these matters, even if it's only intuition. Now, it so happens that we aren't the only people who have thought about this. In fact, the question of how to define the orchestra has been the subject of much academic study, writing, and discussion. Doctoral dissertations have been written, books published, articles have appeared in scholarly journals. Now, on one hand, none of this matters because, like Justice Stewart, we know what it is even if we can't define it. And that's really all that's important. But on the other hand, familiarity with and intimate knowledge of a work of art always leads to greater appreciation and understanding. See, I believe that the orchestra, that magnificent creation of European civilization that over centuries has risen to become the cultural crown jewel of great cities around the world, is more than simply the medium for musical performance. The orchestra is a work of art in and of itself, created not by the hands of a single artist, but by the collective genius of countless thousands of performers and composers who constantly sought better ways to express their musical ideas. Understanding it better is a key to unlocking the secrets of musical masterpieces and of examining the great creative minds of great composers, for whom the orchestra of their day was both the palette and canvas for their expression. The orchestra allowed art that would otherwise be locked in the vault of one composer's consciousness to be freed for all to hear and enjoy. In the next podcast, we'll look at the orchestra's historic origins and how time, place, and people shaped its makeup. Until then, thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay healthy. This is Steve Larson.